an author, author of several books, most recently a book on the Sand Creek Massacre. I'll let Bruce introduce himself, since I always make a mess of that sort of thing.
Bruce. Well, what's there to say at this stage of life? As a writer, I think that's probably what you want to know about.
Well, anything interesting, Bruce.
Well, that may be more interesting than other things. I think people in general may think that they're writers when they're young, but it's one of those vocational activities that you really can't judge until you're older, and most writers don't produce their best work until they're after they're 40. So I'd had to wait a while to find out what my vocation was. I thought I was a writer, and after a while, I think after several books came out, I began to think other people agreed with me. I went to the University of Iowa Writers Program, and that was a very helpful experience, but I think it more helpful even than that was working as a writer in the field. I wrote for the Texas Observer when it first started up in Austin, Texas. It's now a much more exalted and splendid magazine than it was then, but it was a lot of fun, and it was also a good training ground for what you have to do to be an accurate journalistic writer. And I've written fiction, and I've written nonfiction. And with the process of elimination, what my grandmother used to say, by finding out all the things I couldn't do, I found out the thing I could do. I began to work as a poet. And that's been substantially what I have done in the last 25 years. As far as being in Minnesota is concerned, well, this is sort of the last of the several stops along the way. I had a long career as teaching in Kansas, which is a place where I think naughty Minnesotans are often sent to do their penance. I got there not knowing that was a place you were supposed to do your penance, and spent 27 years there. And actually, they were pretty good. On a scale of 1 to 10, I think they were pretty good. And I was head of a creative writing program there, which I started and built at Wichita State University. And I did quite a bit of overseas work, Fulbright teaching and so on and so forth. So, you know, all in all, it was a good training ground for what I needed to do. Now, as far as being here is concerned, I mean permanently or more or less in the Twin Cities, it's a good place for writers. There are a lot of writers around, a lot of opportunities to meet others and to hear what other people are doing. But at this stage of things, there are a few projects that have been hanging over my head from early years, which I've been trying to finish, and one of which is a book entitled The Massacre at Sand Creek, which was published last year by the University of Oklahoma Press. It's not a scholarly work, really. It's a recreation of some of the narrative voices of participants and people who were affected by the massacre of Cheyenne Indians by a party of militia organized by a Methodist minister at the end of the Civil War. Apparently for the purpose of gaining some notoriety for the minister, who had political ambitions and wanted to run for either the Senate or the House of Representatives from the what was then the territory of Colorado, was in the process of becoming a state. And as you know, Peter, in order to get elected, you have to have notoriety of some kind, and apparently that was what he wanted.
Narrative voices, a collection of narrative voices, a recreation of narrative voices. Sounds a tad like a docudrama.
Well, there are, I think after 1945, 46, when the Italian neorealist filmmakers did their work, a lot of things changed in narrative, all kinds of narrative, not just in film narrative. And the representation of events and so on in a in a manner in which the narrative is conducted not by somebody who pretends to be omniscient, but by somebody who pretends to show enough of what happens so that the reader, in the case of a book, or a viewer, in the case of somebody who's watching a film, that those persons can put it together and make sense out of it. That's the thing that I think is important, certainly been important in my work. I don't pretend to be God. I'm not, I haven't got any, aspirations at being an author who tells the reader what to think. My job is to show the reader what might be useful in coming to some conclusions. And to do that, you have to get inside characters and try to figure out what they were up to. There are a certain number of facts you have to take into account, but then there are the motives. And the motivations, well, motivations rely on your insight. And historians have them, and so do poets and novelists. I put myself in the last category, not in the first.
Well, Woodward has been criticized for his last book because he did something very much like what you say you're doing.
Oh, yes.
Would you say that there ought to be a very thick line between journalism and creative prose? Or would you line up with the defenders of Woodward that what needs to happen is a reconstruction?
Well, it's from the point of view of a journalist, which I've been. I think there's a problem because journalists are committed in a certain way ethically to their activity. There's a word, objectivity that creeps into the discussions of what journalists try to do. And while no journalist can be objective in an absolute sense, they have to try. I mean, that's one of the ethical imperatives of journalism as it has been practiced. For people who are interested in imaginative work, there's a sort of an ethical imperative, but it isn't, I wouldn't put it first, poets are not, they're supposed to invent. I mean, that's the whole point of imaginative literature, is to invent. And if that's one of the ground rules, I think most people understand that. And so when a person reads a work of fiction or a narrative of some kind, they understand that this is an invention. It could have a lot of elements of what they understand to be history in it, but those are only elements. Whereas in a historian or in the work of a journalist, they're expecting a different mix.
Well, it's giving the people a whole lot of credit, isn't it? That is, the person who has a sense of the variety of genres and sort of the history of stuff that creeps up on realism but isn't realism. Creeps up on realism, creeps up on objectivity, creeps up on journalism, but yet isn't journalism. People like that make really fine distinctions. Lots of people who grab a book that looks like that has four facts in it that are alleged to be true facts are going to go on to say, well, I've got myself a history here. Yeah, I better read it as a history. Well, I never knew what was going on in that cavalry officer's mind. Oh. Amazing how you can get those things out of the historical record.
Well, if there's some terrible catastrophe and all the other records are obliterated, that's what you end up with is history. And a lot of classical history, Greek and Roman, is more or less what was left after the deluge, and that's what we have to go on. But one of the things that happens to you when you're trying to deal with your experience in an informed way is learning how to discount various things, how to deal with objectivity or the lack of objectivity in writers. And you have to trust readers. I mean, what's the contract here? I mean, are we supposed to sit down with the reader and scold them into doing what they're supposed to do? A reader is supposed to be an active participant, supposed to enter into an experience and have a history and a background and a set of standards and then apply them to whatever it is that the person reads. You know, journalism in the United States has a history to it, and even though people don't necessarily know it, they often feel it. Because many newspapers, particularly newspapers on the Western frontier, by this I mean everything from Pittsburgh west, many newspapers began as land speculation sheets. I mean, they were never designed to give anybody anything other than information that would make them want to come west and buy land. And I can say that the city of Wichita, Kansas, for example, was established by a newspaper. A guy went out there with a press, and there were maybe 200 Wichita Indians camped at the junction of the of a river there, and there were this man, a man named Murdoch, and about five other people who were land speculators, and they began to print a newspaper, and they put that newspaper on the stagecoaches and sent it back east, and everybody thought there was a city there, and they would come and buy the land. I mean, that was the whole point. The Wichita Eagle still exists. I mean, it's still there. And they're still a very commercial enterprise. I mean, they're not exclusively dedicated by any means to selling land, but that's the history of that paper. And there are papers all over the United States that were never started, ever. It's inconceivable to think that they were started as objective opinion organs or that they had political missions in life. They were started to do business. And when you read in the paper today something, a lot of people bring to the newspaper skepticism, which is born out of the maybe unconscious sense that that's how newspapers are. And you have to take what newspapers say with a grain of salt. And that's why newspaper journalists have to work hard at establishing some kind of objectivity, because they know that people, for many reasons other than the one I've just described, have a great deal of skepticism.
Mm. Yeah, and you find, I mean, I find it's creeping in more and more in sources one might have relied on, mind reading, reconstruction, all of the verbal tricks that give a very clear slant to the thing from the word go. Very unsubtle stuff.
There's nothing new about that, I might add. If you read the newspapers of the time of the Sand Creek Massacre, for example, you will find that it's almost impossible to distinguish in those accounts the event, which has now been carefully, painstakingly reconstructed out of the proceedings of courts of inquiry that were established by the United States Army and by the Congress, because a lot of people did care about Indians. I mean, we have the idea that the 19th century was full of really awful people who just tromped around and did awful things, particularly to American Indians. And there were awful people who tramped around. Andrew Jackson was the first of them. But there were also many people in the United States who cared very deeply about it. I mean, there was another tradition of treatment, which it was established by William Penn, as you know, in the Pennsylvania colony. And this was a considerate, honorable treatment based on mutual rights and obligations. And when massacres occurred, such as the one at Sand Creek, a lot of people got upset. And there were inquiries, and there were successful efforts made to establish the facts. But you won't find these very much in the newspaper. You might find, you know, it's a little bit, but the newspapers were all land speculator, gold speculator organs. The Rocky Mountain News was one of the prime ones. In fact, there's kind of a humorous bit in my book about a flash flood that occurs, and it washes away the printing press of the Rocky Mountain News, and one of my characters writes home and says, well, that takes care of the hapless liars that own that organ. That's the only way you can get rid of it is by having a flood, and then it goes somewhere else, and then they have to go off and get another press and come back and start publishing their so-called newspaper. There were people that cared, but they didn't necessarily find that their cares were represented in the news organs of the time. It took 132 years for the Methodist Church to finally formally apologize to the Cheyenne Nation. It did it this year in the General Assembly or Council of the Methodist Church. It took 132 years for them to apologize to the Cheyenne Nation that a minister, an elder of the Methodist Church, had organized the Sand Creek Massacre. So if it takes 132 years for that to happen, figure how it must have been at the time. I mean, people of goodwill may well have known what the circumstances were, but they were not in the position to know. And so journalism has this burden to carry. I mean, they have this problem. And it's maybe only in very recent years, certainly not William Randolph Hearst, and certainly not Bertie McCormick of the Chicago Tribune. I mean, none of these people did anything very much to establish objectivity in newspaper activity. But only maybe since Vietnam, or maybe since the end of World War II and the Korean War, have we had a drive ethically among journalists to try to achieve objectivity in their work. And, you know, it's not very old. And maybe it won't succeed. It's always possible.
So far from being the expected thing, the standard, just the way it ought to be, objectivity in journalism is a sort of fragile flower. Very recent, very much outside of the old tradition of American journalism, and always challenged by various movements in journalism even today that take facts to be whatever a loud mouth can say they are at any given time.
Well, it's even trickier than that, Peter, because what used to appear to be simple, that is, you got the morning newspaper or the afternoon newspaper or both, and you read them, and then you came to some kind of conclusions about what it was that went on in the world, what the news was. But now we have a very different situation. We have a situation in which what you think of as news is coming at you from a television screen, from the radio, from the newspapers, what people say. I mean, hearsay and rumor is still extremely important, I would say. In the United States, it's extremely important. So that it isn't a clear line, and who is responsible for all of this is not clear either. I mean, a newspaper article is usually now signed. I mean, or at least it's identified, its origin is identified. But in a radio situation or in many television situations, it's not that way. You just get something, an image of something, and it appears to be a certain way, and you form your opinion of it. You don't know who was responsible for it, and you have no way to trace it, because once you've seen it, it's gone. It might be in the file somewhere down in a television station, but you're not going to be able to go and look again, because once it's gone by you, it's gone. You see, it's ephemeral. And I think it's maybe more of a problem now just because one effort is being made in journalism in terms of the newsprint, in terms of the news media, newspapers. But in other areas, it's maybe more slippery. That's why poets say, okay, we have all, our history is clear. I mean, fiction writers, poets, dramatists, our history is clear. We invent. We make no pretenses at trying to be objective. We've never tried to be objective. We've only tried to invent that which might well have been. That's all we can do. And if it's our best shot, we hope that those who read or watch or in some other way participate in our work will get a sense of what it was all about. But it's not the same kind of activity, and the ground rules are quite different than they are for journalism and history.
But I'd like to think about what a best shot is. I mean, my guess is Norman Mailer, Gore Vidal, you know, have different, you, Capote, all of whom in some sense latched on to a piece of reality as the stuff of their writing, have different notions of what a best shot counts as. I'm wondering kind of what your notion is. And then part of that question is the question, what is the ethic here, the underlying ethic of fidelity to the real thing, the real event that's working in your work?
You mentioned Capote. I suppose In Cold Blood was what you had in mind. I was in Kansas when he came to do that book. In fact, we met. He came through where I was working in. And he was going to a town where I had a number of students who had come from there, and he followed up on some of the leads out there through them. This was a period, I think this is a really interesting period in Capote's career. It was an extraordinary piece of work. I really think it was an extraordinary. I don't think there's anything quite like In Cold Blood. Not perfect by any means, but it's an unusually shrewd effort to penetrate into a situation that journalistically is inexplicable. I mean, why is it that two guys who don't know these people go out and, in a really cruel way, find them and kill them, or torture them and kill them? I mean, what is it? You know, it was in the 50s, we used to call this motiveless crime. And I think what Capote did was to try to open a door to suggest that there is no such thing as a motiveless crime. I mean, all crime has a motive. The problem is that we're accustomed to thinking of certain motives as being appropriate for certain kinds of crimes, and we are way off base. I mean, there's a whole other range of motives which are more difficult to see, but are certainly adequate for doing that. And his book opened that door. And I don't think after In Cold Blood we ever talked about motiveless crime again. We talked about random killing or other things like that, but the motiveless part dropped out. And it was a good piece of journalism. I really do think it was a good piece of journalism. I think he drew all these lines very carefully so that you knew where you were in terms of what was recorded fact and what was the intuition that he was giving you. It did straddle a line between fiction and journalism, which a lot of other people have tried to straddle since then. But I would really say that that was one of the most successful, I thought. And he really worked hard on that. I mean, he had a lot of talent. And for some reason, that event called up in him a kind of a motive, a deep motive. For the money he got out of that project, he put a lot more time and effort into it on his standards, you know. I mean, he's used to being well paid. I mean, it really never paid him what he put into it, but it was a substantial achievement.
And do you see that as a model for the kind of thing you're doing in the massacre at Sand Creek?
No, because I can't interview people. I mean, I can't go to a place and interview the people who were the direct participants. He could do that. What I have to do is go back to a time when there are no living persons around. But the problem is that I see is that here we had a whole 19th century go by. A lot of very important things happened in the 19th century, right? I mean, let's just start with the Civil War. Out of the Civil War came only one and maybe or two first-rate works of fiction, imaginative fiction. One of which was written 30 years after it was over. That was Stephen Crane's book. And then some short stories by Ambrose Bierce, which were written after the fact. But otherwise, the Civil War doesn't exist in American letters, really. A lot of things in the 19th century really don't exist in American letters. I mean, Indians don't really exist. If you think Longfellow's Indians are worth preserving, I mean, the 19th century just didn't see its experience in the terms that we now think of as adequate artistically. And so it may be a crotchet of mine, but one of the things I have felt I had to do, and particularly in this project, is to go back and put it into the real motives and the real terms that we can accept in contemporary literature and establish, you know, what happened. What was that experience? What was the part of American intellectual, cultural, artistic life that should have been taken up in that experience that wasn't? And at least we have maybe something to deal with, even if it wasn't from the time.
So part of, the word that comes to mind is a sort of redemption. When you have it in mind to redeem a piece of the 19th century, or maybe redemption with a religious echo of sort of saving its soul. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? I mean, is that to kind of get it to tell the truth?
Well, yeah, that's a way of saying it. The 19th century was, it's easy to overlook it and say, well, it was a time of this and that, it was when the slaves were freed or whatever. It was much more complicated than that, and it was much more important to the way we are today than we are willing to admit. Racial attitudes, social class attitudes, political party organizations and attitudes, the tendency to solve problems through violence or the use of force. They may all have been inherent in American society, but they really come to a head in the 19th century, and you can see very clearly racial attitudes, for example. I mean, you think that killing Indians is not, it's not easy for anybody to do, but a lot of people in the 19th century found it relatively easy to do because of their racial attitudes. And how did they get these racial attitudes? They got them from scientists. And who were these scientists? They were the scientists of the 19th century. They were the ethnologists, who that's what they call themselves, who had discovered that the white race was the most perfectly developed race of all the races. You got it from the trichologists. These were the guys who specialized in the study of hair. And if you can believe it, they had discovered that the most perfect hair in the human family was on the heads of white people. Yeah. And you got it from phrenologists, guys who read the bumps on your head. And this was, don't laugh, this is a science. Man, we're talking about, you know, the American Academy of Science. They're going around saying, well, the bumps on white people's heads show that white people are really much more intelligent and should rule the earth. When the Mexican War broke out in 1846, even Walt Whitman, the beloved Walt Whitman, our Democrat, wrote an editorial in which he said it was it was too bad that there was going to be a war, but it was a good thing that we're going to go down there and show those Mexicans what the white race could do for them. So what are you going to do? I mean, this is the 19th century that gives us the 20th century. And it's all there. If you want to go back and look at it, that's what it is. But I don't think people go back and look at it. I don't think they're really interested. They are only interested in the things they know, which are Melville, Hawthorne, Emily Dickinson, and Walt Whitman. And all this other stuff is not there, just absent. Mm-hmm.